Genesis 19:1-29, the 20th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 9, 2001 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2001. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Genesis chapter 19 today. This is the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. On the one hand, the story, I think, is depressing in that it's disgustingly wicked. But on the other hand, it's encouraging in that in the midst of that, God reaches in and does his saving work. I'll read through this first section, the first part of chapter 19, and then I'll talk about various issues within it, and then I want to talk about two issues in particular after we go through the narrative. Chapter 19 of Genesis, verse 1. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, "Now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way." They said, however, "No, but we shall spend the night in the square." Yet he urged them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he prepared a feast for them, and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may have relations with them." But Lot went out to them at the doorway, and shut the door behind him, and said, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you, and do to them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand aside." Furthermore, they said, "This one came in as an alien, and already he is acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them." So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. Then the men said to Lot, "Whom else have you here? A son-in-law, your sons and your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, bring them out of the place. For we are about to destroy this place because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." And Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, and said, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. And when morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city." But he hesitated. So the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him. And they brought him out and put him outside the city. And it came about, when they had brought them outside, that one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you, and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, lest you be swept away." But Lot said to them, "Oh, no, my lords. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please let me escape there. Is it not small? That my life may be saved." And he said to him, "Behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town of which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there." Therefore the name of the town was called Zoar. The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came in Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But his wife from behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now Abraham arose early in the morning and went to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward the land of the valley. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. Thus it came about, when God destroyed the cities of the valley, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. I find it very easy to identify with Lot in this story, and as we go through, I think you'll see how there are many features of his life that correspond to our own lives. As I argued last week, in chapter 18, we see these same two travelers coming to Abraham, and we see how he receives them. He receives them very graciously. He sees them coming as an opportunity for him to be generous and hospitable. It is a favor to him that they allow him to be hospitable to them. And he rushes out to meet them. He bows down before them. He begs them to come and enjoy his hospitality. And then he is very, very generous. He provides an elaborate meal, because they are there. That, then, stands in contrast to the way that the people of Sodom greet these travelers. Their response to these travelers is very, very different. But there's also another comparison that's built into this narrative, and that is a comparison between Abraham and Lot. And I think that the author is encouraging us to look at that comparison. The two angels are two of the three that appeared to Abraham. One of them lingered to talk with Abraham, and then he disappears from the narrative. We only have two remaining. Both of them make it down to Sodom from Hebron, where they had spoken with Abraham. Apparently, that's a full day's journey to go from Hebron to down to the Dead Sea, but they made it from after lunch. They arrived in Sodom evening before dark, so they must have stayed in the fast lane. They arrive in the evening, and there, Lot is sitting in the gates of Sodom. Now, it's not clear what it means that he was sitting in the gates. The gates of a city of that time was the center of town, in a sense. The gates are it's a large area where you enter into the city, and that's where the farmer's market is. That's where courts were held, courts of justice, and that's where the officials of the city would sit in their official capacity. When it says that Lot was sitting in the gates, it's not clear whether that means that he was just present there or whether he was sitting there in an official capacity. Both of those are possible, and it's not clear from the narrative. In any case, he's sitting at the gate, much like Abraham was sitting at the door of his tent. He looks up, he sees them, he comes out to meet them, he bows down, his face to the ground. All of that is similar to Abraham. The only difference is in the story of Abraham, Abraham ran out to meet them. We just have Lot going out to meet them. He addresses them as my lords, the same form of address that Abraham had used. Then he invites them to come and enjoy his hospitality, but it is a less elaborate invitation than the one that Abraham had used. And he says, he concludes his invitation by saying, you can come and enjoy my hospitality, and you can get up early in the morning and leave. That's a very ominous remark. And I think there are a lot of implications of that. One is, Lot knows the people with whom he lives. He knows what kinds of things they do. And it seems highly likely that what is about to happen has happened before. This is not the first time that the men of Sodom have done this to travelers. Lot is anticipating. And I suspect that means this has happened before, not just one time, but probably more than once, such that Lot knows the pattern. And I suspect that this is why God came in the form, sent the angels in the form of travelers. They first appear to Abraham, and he greets them with hospitality. Then those travelers go to Sodom because this outrage has happened before. And he's going to see if the outcry was true. And so he goes as in the form of travelers to see what kind of hospitality they provide to people that come there. Lot is insistent. He pushes them, but he encourages them greatly to come and stay at his house. They say, well, we'll just stay in the square. He says, no, no, no. Come and stay with me. I insist. Abraham had been insistent because it was a favor to him to be able to provide the hospitality. Lot is insistent, but his motivation seems to be more to spare these travelers what fate he expects to befall them if they don't. Then Lot provides a meal. Abraham would provide a meal. He said, let me give you a piece of bread, is the term that he uses in chapter 18. Then he goes out and goes to great lengths to prepare a very elaborate meal. He has a calf killed. He has his wife fix bread with the finest of flour. He brings milk and curds. I think that's it. With Lot, the narrative says that he prepared a feast, but all that it mentions is unleavened bread, which is kind of the daily, quick and easy meal. So we see that Lot was hospitable. Lot was concerned about the welfare of these travelers. But it really pales by comparison with the hospitality that was provided by Abraham. And I think that that disparity is intentional on the part of the author. There is an edge that has been lost to Lot's faith that we see sharply in Abraham, but the culture that Lot is immersed in has dulled that edge. So the travelers go with Lot. He provides them with a meal, but before they turn out the lights and go to bed, the men of Sodom come. And it makes it clear that this is not just a few men from Sodom. This is representative of the whole city. Now, I think it's highly unlikely that literally all of the men came, because Sodom, as from archaeological findings, was a rather large city and wealthy, I might add. They had two resources that were very valuable at the time. One was tar, and we know that there was tar in the area because after the battle that was described in chapter 14 between the kings of the cities of the plain and the kings of the east, that some of the kings of the cities of the plain fell into the tar pits and died. So they had tar, which was very valuable and was particularly desired in Egypt because they used it in the process of mummification. The other resource they had that was very valuable was copper. And this is the Copper Age that we're talking about. So the state-of-the-art weapons were made at this time of copper or bronze, bronze needs copper, right? Copper and tin. So this was a very valuable city, a very wealthy city, and fairly heavily populated. I don't know how many, but the estimates run 40 to 50,000 at its low time of the year, up to 100,000 people in the summers. But men come from every part of the city, and old and young men. So it's a substantial sampling of the whole spectrum of men from Sodom. It's possible that this is a semi-organized kind of thing. They've done it before, and this is what you do. This is the pattern. They gather and approach the travelers. And what they ask is that they want Lot to send these men out so that they may have relations with them. The word here is the standard word to know, which can just mean to know and to get to know, but it also is used in a sexual sense. And I think that that's the most probable sense here in this context. That what they want to do is gang rape, homosexual gang rape on these travelers. Now, what are they doing? Why would they want to do this? Well, according to rabbinic tradition, this was the practice that was done to discourage travelers from coming to a city. That the thinking was, it's our stuff. No one else ought to have any claim to the stuff that we have here. We've worked hard for it. And for freeloaders to come and think that they can enjoy our stuff without doing the work that we did, that's outrageous. So we don't want those freeloaders coming and taking from our resources. If that, I don't know if that's what's happening here. We do see this elsewhere. There's a very, very similar account in Judges 19 in which the people come and want to gang rape, homosexual gang rape on a traveler that visits the city. This time it's an Israelite city. So there are other places in the Old Testament where this same thing happens, but it's, I don't know for sure what the motivation is behind it. In any case, Lot comes to their defense. And what's fascinating about this is Lot shows a great deal of bravery here. And yet everything that he does only makes matters worse. It's a very clumsy attempt. He goes outside of his door. He shuts the door behind himself. That's a very brave thing for him to do. He's putting himself in harm's way and in an effort to try to protect the guests that are under his roof. He asks them not to act wickedly. He appeals to their conscience, which is obviously futile. Then he offers his daughters. He says, you can't have them, but I have two daughters who are virgins. Let me send them out to you. That seems so bizarre. Presumably, in the culture, it was more understandable. Apparently, the importance and the responsibility that you took on when you brought guests into your house to have hospitality was such a high value that one had to sacrifice. One felt obligated to sacrifice their daughters in order to save these guests. But this seems to indicate that even if this practice is largely punitive, a way of keeping travelers away, that it has to be at least to some degree driven by lust in order for this to be a possible substitute. In any case, it doesn't work. Their response is... Their response is, here is this outsider. Here is this foreigner. Here's this guy who didn't grow up here. He's moved in. And now he's telling us what's right and what's wrong. What gives him the right to tell us what's right and what's wrong? He's a foreigner. I have thought about this from time to time. There is something about the presence of someone who upholds high standards of morality that is a problem anytime they're in a society of people who are guilt-ridden. That just their presence is an irritant. Because someone who is given over to wickedness, one of their biggest problems is being haunted by guilt, being haunted by their conscience. And the easiest way to solve that conscience is to have everyone around you say, it's okay. What you're doing is okay. And to have one dissenting voice is enough to twinge that conscience that's trying to be put to sleep. And here we have Lot speaking out as one voice saying, this is wickedness. And that twinges the conscience. And therefore, someone like that needs to be stilled. Someone like that needs to be quieted. So they push on Lot, and they go to break down the door. So things just escalate. The situation is getting out of control. So the angels then open the door, they reach out and grab Lot and bring him inside. They're taking over now. They will solve this problem. And a dazzling light, there's a blindness that comes over these men because of a dazzling light. Apparently it's a temporary kind of blindness. And they then are groping around trying to find the door. This is one of the most pathetic scenes in all of the Bible. I mean, if you were just blinded, you would think that you would no longer be preoccupied with this wicked thing that you were attempting to do. There would be enough to make you think, well, maybe I should do something else. Maybe I should go home. Maybe I should grovel my way home or something. No, they're looking for the door. It's just, that is so pathetic. It's incredible. And they wearied trying to find the door. Then the angels tell Lot, get your family ready to go. God is going to destroy this place. And they ask, who do you have here? And Lot has his wife, his two daughters, and two sons-in-law-to-be. So Lot goes out to tell these sons-in-law-to-be, pack up, we're getting out of here. First thing in the morning. And the response of the sons-in-law is they think that he's joking. That's very interesting because here we have two men that are about to be married to the two daughters of Lot, and yet clearly they are a part of the culture. They don't trust Lot. I mean, if someone came to you in the night and said, we got to leave before morning, God is going to nuke this place. What you'd have to do is trust the person that's telling you that. If you don't trust the person that's telling that, you're going to say, oh, it's not going to happen. But you have to have some reason to believe that that person is speaking authoritatively. They look at Lot and they don't think he's speaking authoritatively. This is just one of those rumors that goes around over the internet. And so they think it's a joke. They are not ready to go. Lot goes back home. And so it's down to just the four of them that will be leaving. Daylight comes, and the angels say it's time to go. And then we have this statement, Lot hesitated. There's something that Sodom has a certain pull on him. And I suspect that the pull is Sodom has so much to offer. It's wealthy. It has comforts that he's never experienced before. It's exciting. It is alluring. It just has so much, humanly speaking, it has so much to offer. And I think we can all identify that. You can see that in any, especially in big cities. For us, from a small city, you go to a big city and you can feel the energy. And there's so much happening. There's so much that's interesting. There's so much that's attractive. And it's difficult to not want all that it has to offer. So Lot hesitates. But the angels take him by the hand. And they pull him and his daughters and his wife. So they are physically pulling him out of the city. And they say, run to the mountains. Lot says, it's too far. I can't make it. He says, there's a little town over here. What if I just run there? And the angels are very compassionate. They say, okay. That's okay. Well, we will allow that. And so they grant this concession to his weaknesses. And he goes to the city. He arrives then at Zoar, and Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed. Fire and brimstone come down and destroy the cities as well as all the plants and everything. They were told, don't look back. But Lot's wife had such an attachment to the city, she cannot help herself. She looks back, and she's obviously looking back with longing. She's looking back thinking, that's what we're leaving behind. And she is turned to a pillar of salt as a result of that. Then Abraham gets up in the morning and he looks out towards Hebron. Remember, the day before, he had had a discussion with God. And he had told God, you can't destroy all of Sodom, because if you were to destroy all of Sodom, there are righteous people that would be destroyed with that destruction. And that's not the kind of thing that you do. You don't mix the righteous with the wicked in your destruction. So in that discussion, Abraham convinces God that if there are 10 righteous people in Sodom, that he should spare the city. And God agrees to that. Well, now he's looking out and he sees the smoke. And he's got to be going, there weren't 10? I mean, all we needed was 10. And there weren't 10. And it says that Lot was saved because God remembered, what does it say? Thus it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. I think what it's talking about there is God remembered what he had promised to Abraham. And the spirit of what God had promised to Abraham was God was not going to destroy the righteous with the wicked. That was the whole essence of Abraham's argument. And God is remembering that. God was intent on doing that very thing. That is, sparing the righteous from this disaster. And he did so. He brought Lot out of Sodom. So as we look at this chapter as a whole, then, it's very clear that God is determined to punish the wicked. But he is going to spare the righteous. He's going to do whatever it takes to spare the righteous from that same punishment. And that's what he did with Lot, and it took a lot of pulling to extricate Lot from that situation. Okay, there are two issues that I'd like to talk about. One is, what was Sodom's sin? And I talked a little bit about that last week, so I won't go into that in great depth. And then talk about Lot in Sodom, in Lot being in a wicked culture. What was Sodom's sin? I think that we need to understand what Sodom's sin was by contrast with Abraham and Abraham's hospitality and generosity. That Abraham, as I've already mentioned, he saw these travelers as an opportunity for him to do, to be of service. Their presence and their acceptance of his hospitality, he saw that as a favor to him. Abraham has come to the point where he trusts God with his own best interests. God has proven himself faithful to Abraham. Abraham can entrust himself to God and let God take care of his best interests. And that grants Abraham an incredible freedom. The freedom that it grants him is the freedom to look around and see where he could be of service to others. He can be looking out for the interests of others because God is looking out for his interests. That's an incredible freedom. And that's the freedom that Abraham has come to have. Sodom, on the other hand, when they see these travelers and understand that these travelers, these are people that are at a disadvantage relative to Abraham when they come to him. Since they are traveling, they don't have the resources. They don't have as much food at hand. They don't have good shelter. They don't have the servants, etc., that Abraham has available to him. So they are at a relative disadvantage with respect to Abraham in this particular situation. That means Abraham has power with respect to them in this situation. How does Abraham use that power that he has? He uses it to the benefit of those who are disadvantaged. In Sodom, it's just the opposite. They are concerned about their own self-interests. They are preoccupied with their own self-interests, such that their perspective is hoarding. Their perspective is hold on to what you have because that's the only security that you've got. As a result, travelers then are a drain on that. They are a problem. And so they use their power advantage to take advantage of or to mistreat then the travelers rather than to use it to the benefit of the travelers. Now there are two things in the passage that steer me. There's one thing in the passage and there's one thing elsewhere that steer me in that direction of understanding the sin of Sodom. One is that God says that an outcry has come to him. And when that term is used in the Old Testament, it's associated with an outcry related to oppression of those who are in need. So I assume that that's the kind of outcry here. And that's supported by what it says in Ezekiel 16, verse 49. In Ezekiel is reprimanding the Israelites and saying, you are no better than the people of Sodom. You are just as wicked. And in that context, Ezekiel says, only this was the sin of your sister Sodom, arrogance. She and her daughters had plenty of bread and untroubled tranquility, yet she did not support the poor and the needy. So the sin of Sodom, when you boil it down to its essence, is a self-centeredness. They are so preoccupied with their own self-interests that they hoard everything that they have. They cannot be hospitable, charitable, or generous, because that would jeopardize their own well-being from their perspectives. So, why does this manifest itself in this homosexual gang rape? Why would they be driven in that direction? I think the answer to that is it is outrageous. It is such a perversion of what God intended. It is so contrary to nature. And I think throughout the Bible, the perspective on homosexuality is not that it is the worst sin that one can commit. It's just one among many evil things that a person can do. But there is something that is peculiar about homosexuality in that it is so against nature. It's the kind of thing that any right-thinking person would look on and they'd say, there's something really wrong there. There's a craziness that has come over anyone who would engage in that sort of activity. And I think that there are probably a number of ways that we can tell that it's not the way things were meant to be. But very, very simply, anatomically, it doesn't work. And secondly, it doesn't produce children. And then I'm sure there are other ways as well, but just very, very basically, those things are certainly true. So homosexuality is a clear instance of the rebelliousness of man leading them in a direction that makes no sense. It's craziness. No sane person would go that way. And I think that's why it becomes singled out as a quintessential evil. Not because it's so very, very bad above all other sins, but it's because it's so very, very unnatural. There's got to be craziness involved here. And then, this is not just homosexual sex, but it's homosexual rape. And you think about it. God made sex, but he made it to be an expression of the most intimate kind of love. And then to take that and use that as a way of abusing someone else, it's the exact opposite of that for which it was intended. So we've got homosexuality and rape combined. What could be more unnatural? What could be more foolish, more insane? So the arrogance of the people of Sodom has driven them in a direction where they've lost touch with reality. There's a craziness. And that's becoming manifested in this incident where travelers come to town and they want to gang rape them. Okay. Now, looking at Lot, I think this is real food for thought. Did Lot do wrong? Remember, Lot first comes to Sodom as a result of conflict that developed between Lot and Abraham and their shepherds. And they had too many animals for too little ground, and so there was friction that developed between the two households. So Abraham said, you know, we've got to split because we need to salvage our relationship. We need to go our separate ways. And Abraham told Lot, you choose. You choose where to go and I'll go to the other place. And Lot looks down into the well-watered valley and says, I'll take that. And I think in the narrative we are to understand that even there was grasping on Lot's part. That he took the best part for himself, looking out for his own interests. So I think that we are to understand that Lot made a mistake there by choosing the well-watered valley. He goes down, and the next thing we know, he's moved his tents close to Sodom. So he's not just living in the valley, but he's migrating to the city, and a wicked city, and one that in the text is described even before Lot moves there as a wicked city. Then, when the kings from the east sweep through, they take Lot as part of their loot when they conquer those cities. Obviously, he's a part of what's happening there. And then here, he has moved within the city. He's sitting in the gates. We don't know whether he's a leader in the city or just a regular participant in. When Lot comes and tells them, we got to get out of here, this place is going to be destroyed, they think that he's joking. So there's no resonance in spirit there. And we know that when it comes time to go, Lot hesitates. So there's no question in my mind but what Lot has been seduced by the culture of Sodom. That it just offers so much that he cannot turn down. He can't walk away from it. That's on the one hand. But on the other hand, he clearly agonizes over what he sees in the city. The fact that when these travelers come, that he says, oh, you got to stay with me. He's running a risk there, and he's got to know he's running a risk. But he wants them to stay with him because that's the only way that they're going to be protected. And when the men come, he says, this is a wicked thing that you are about to do. That's very brave. He's standing up for right principles, and very bravely so. So did Lot do wrong? I suspect that he made some bad choices. But nevertheless, God is very compassionate towards Lot. And God comes in and takes him out of the city in a clear indication of God's determination to save those people who he has chosen. He is going to do what it takes to keep us from being swept away into the culture. When I think about, we're all in that situation that we are living in a wicked culture. I hope that's clear to everyone. It certainly is to me. I told you that last week I did duty at the beer garden at the Duck football game. And I would have to say that I came away from that feeling a little bit dirty. Just seeing a side of my society that I don't see often. But these are people that are around us all the time, and just seeing, and there was nothing outrageous that happened there. It was just a lot of lost and lonely people desperately trying to grasp for meaning and significance in life, and doing very foolish things in order to try to get that. And you look at that and you say, you just shake your head and you go, it is so sad. It is so sad. But we're surrounded by that all the time. Does that mean that we should flee Eugene? Well, where are you going to go? A number of years ago, I went to do some farming in Wamek, Oregon, which is about as far from anything as you can get. It's just east of Mount Hood up in the high plateau. And it's out in the middle of nowhere. There's the big city is probably 45 minutes to an hour's drive away, and that's Madras. And I only worked there for a week. I left because I became convinced that the guy that I was, the farmer that I was working with and staying with, was a militant homosexual, and decided that I didn't care to keep staying in that house. But what I learned in that week was the place is just filled with drugs and sex. I mean, we're out in the sticks. We're out in nowhere. And what do they do in the winter when they aren't driving their tractors? They're popping pills. And that's all they were talking about. And it just it amazed me. I mean, the city has gone everywhere. There's no place that isn't the city in our country anymore, I'm convinced. So where are you going to go? But even if there were a place, does that mean that we should flee and go to that place? Well, I'm not. I mean, everyone would have to make that judgment. I mean, if you had the opportunity, maybe. But I'm not sure that that's the solution. The more important solution, I think, is we have to learn how to be in the culture without being swallowed up by it, without becoming adopting its values and its assumptions. That's a very difficult thing to do, but I think that's what we have to do. Jacques Ellul, in his book, The Meaning of City, talks about this, and it's a very interesting book, and especially with respect to this question. What he argues is the city, and what he means by the city is he's talking about human society. And he's looking at city and how city is talked about throughout the Bible. And what he says is there is a constant theme all through the Bible, and that is the city is where the wickedness of man manifests itself. You bring people together, and it's like concentrating the wickedness of man. And so the city becomes the epitome of wickedness. But does the Bible say we should flee the city? And his observation is, interestingly, no, it doesn't. In the end, God is going to redeem that city. What is in the new heavens? What is the new heavens, new earth? We have the new Jerusalem, a city. So God has this pattern of taking the wickedness that we produce and then redeeming that. That's a very important theme, and that it's very significant. But Ellul says what we need to do is be in the city, but don't build the city. We need to be an integral part of the city, working towards the welfare of our community, but not buying into its values and not furthering its project of taking more and more of the world into our control, into our hands. That we need to draw the line at not furthering its project of remaking creation to our liking. So however you want to word it, we have to find this balance of being a part of this thing, but not absorbing, not becoming committed to its values. That's a very difficult task. And what I've found in my life is there are issues come up, and you think that you have resolved them, but they never really get resolved. That same issue just reemerges in a slightly different form. So, for instance, one of them is money. thinking about money. That's something that we have to come back and revisit all the time. That money's neither here nor there is really the biblical perspective. And I'm convinced that that's true. And I've been convinced that that's true in a number of different situations. But I can guarantee you another situation will come along which will raise that same issue. What is the value of money in a way that I haven't seen it before, and I'm going to have to fight that battle again. That's the nature of living in society like this. That's just the way it's going to be. We're going to have to keep revisiting these same issues. And it's a matter of reminding ourselves and reminding each other of what is true. Keeping a steady course and not being distracted by the glitter and the beads and the baubles on both sides of us that society throws up. The encouraging thing, though, in this account is God saved Lot out of this anyway. God is indeed committed to his people. And even if we hesitate, God's going to take us by the hand and pull us out. So ultimately, God is we're in God's hands, and we can trust him. He'll take care of us. We are over time. So if you have questions or comments, write them down, and we can talk about them next week. Thanks.